Renegade Broadcasting, hard-hitting talk radio. Welcome to a special Thursday edition of The Blitz. This is your host, Kyle Hunt, coming to you October 24th, 2019. Thank you so much for tuning in to RenegadeBroadcasting.com. Please check out RenegadeTribune.com and head on over to HeathenHerbs.com. We've got a sale that'll be running for another week here, so if you order over $50 worth of products, you'll get $10 off. I've also fixed the shipping so that it should be a bit more accurate and you won't get overcharged. I had some issues trying to calculate the shipping before, but now everything seems to be good. All right, so tonight here, I just wanted to go over some more information about diet. I know it's everybody's favorite subject, but seriously, guys, it is so very important, not just to our own health, but to the health of the world. And we are doing a great injustice, not only to ourselves, but to the other living sentient creatures of this world, by continuing to live in the way that we do, consuming vast amounts of meat and dairy. Now, I know that a lot of people are fed up with all of the vegan shilling that goes on in this network, but seriously, guys, there is meat shilling that goes on throughout the most part, throughout almost the entirety of the right wing, alt-right, whatever culture. I know veganism is usually something associated with the left, but it does not have to be. Just look at the leadership of the Third Reich. You had Heinrich Himmler, a vegetarian, Rudolf Hess, a vegetarian, Hitler, a vegetarian. Now, they weren't vegans, but I actually think that they would be if they had lived a bit longer and found out some more of the research just about how bad dairy can be for you. I think it was absolutely exceptional that the leadership at that time was vegetarian. Where else in the world did you have a country being led by vegetarians? So for people to say that it is Jewish to promote the veganism and abstaining from animal products in general, that is pretty ridiculous, considering the last great uprising against the Jews was actually done by vegetarians. Now, a lot of the arguments as to why people should go vegan or plant-based or whatever you want to call it usually revolve around the atrocities committed against these animals. The conditions are absolutely disgusting. And it's not been one of my main focuses, though it does definitely play a part in my decisions. That's actually why I first started to adopt this lifestyle, was because I just could not stomach it anymore, what I was, you know, actually consuming. Just because it's called a hamburger doesn't actually make it so. What it is the tortured flesh of a cow that has had a very poor life. Ooh, and bacon. Sizzling bacon. Yep, you got some tortured pork bellies there. It's just, it's not right. And most people would not actually eat meat if they knew what it was that they were consuming. They like to put it in the back of their minds, so they don't really associate, you know, the food on their plate to the animal that was cruelly slaughtered. And what I find so sick too are the signs for restaurants, barbecue joints, and everything, where they'll have a big smiling pig as their icon, you know, as their big logo out there. It's just so terrible. But you know, it's not just about the animals. It's also about the environment. And so huge arguments can be made about the devastating effects of animal agriculture on our environment. A good documentary that people have watched about that would be Cowspiracy. And there are a number of other ones that deal with a similar topic. As for the awful treatment of the animals. I'm pretty sure there's one called Earthlings. I didn't actually watch that. That was one that came out a few years ago that I guess was pretty powerful, and it goes through all the abuses. And then there are documentaries that deal with the health impacts of high meat, high dairy consumption. In particular, I think Forks Over Knives would be a good example of that. And these documentaries also show just how effective a plant-based whole foods diet is with curing a lot of the diseases of the modern world. So you can see that there is a direct connection to the food we eat and our overall health. Now, I like this last approach the best, because people are sometimes pretty selfish. I'm not saying that necessarily as a bad thing. You know, you could tell them all day long about how their diet is negatively impacting the environment or these other animals, and they'll say, oh yeah, that's a terrible thing. But until you show them how it's negatively impacting themselves, there might not be a change. And sadly, you can get them to 100% agree that their diet is not doing them any justice. They're not doing well because of the diet they eat, and yet they won't change it. They feel like they can't. They're addicted. Or they just don't have the willpower to go ahead and make a switch to something healthier. One of the big problems I see is that men have been conditioned through Bernays-type advertising to associate meat eating with manliness. You aren't a man unless you can go out to the store and buy a big sirloin steak and grill it up. You know, it's not even that these guys are going out and hunting their own food. They're not going off into the woods and killing it and then skinning it and doing all the rest, which I find, you know, disgusting to begin with, and unnecessary. That's the thing. It's completely unnecessary. Well, listen, my last name is Hunt. If I lived in a different time, in different age, with different circumstances, I'd probably be out there in the woods hunting down food. But it's not necessary. Not today. And it is not helping us to live a healthy lifestyle. But here's the thing. The vast majority of the meat that is consumed is not hunted. Most of the animals that are slaughtered don't even see the light of the day. I mean, it's just disgusting. Billions of animals every single year who are raised in the most disgusting conditions, who then meet a very, very awful end, you know, after a short, tortured life. That should not be the way that we get our energy, our fuel for life. There obviously are disastrous consequences, not just karmic ones, but biological ones. And so for men in particular to get over this meat is manly type mindset, I think is crucial. And that's why a recent documentary that came out could be very beneficial in breaking this myth apart. And I know that this documentary is being promoted somewhat in the mainstream. It's on Netflix, it's on iTunes, it's everywhere. It may even be on Amazon Prime. It's called The Game Changers. It was produced by James Cameron, which, you know, might indicate that it's part of some agenda. I don't think it's... Okay, here's the thing. Maybe there is some agenda behind this. I don't know. I can't see why making people healthy would have an agenda behind it. But the fact of the matter is that what is presented in the documentary is scientifically sound. And so this documentary called The Game Changers also features Arnold Schwarzenegger. I am no big fan of him. He makes a very small percentage of the screen time when he's on there speaking. And what it does is it highlights all of these vegan athletes and tells their stories and just the amount of success that they've been able to have. And it goes through kind of point by point why being on a whole foods plant-based diet is optimal for someone who is trying to reach peak physical performance. it goes through and talks to some fighters, right? You see the, it's actually supposedly done by this guy who was a former UFC fighter, and he was trying to figure out how to best heal after two knee injuries. And then he came upon some information about the gladiators and how they were known as the Barley Men and how they were pretty much living on a vegan diet. And these were the elite fighters of the day. They were essentially like the UFC fighters of today, although sometimes they would die. And, you know, Olympic cyclists, power lifters, it just goes on and on. The Tennessee Titans, with I think about a third of their starting lineup being vegan, while they had the best season they'd ever had for quite some time. And it deals with things like just, male sexual performance. Guys, how manly is meat eating when it will probably lead you to have ED, erectile dysfunction, at some point? That's a direct consequence of eating a lot of meat, is the blood won't be flowing properly. And you know what? All that animal estrogen that you're taking in with your meat and dairy, that might not be helping things either. So this documentary goes through and shows what your blood looks like after consuming either, let's say, a vegan burrito as compared to a meat burrito. And it goes through and compares just male sexual performance through a kind of a shoddy scientific experiment. Or not shoddy, just a ridiculous one. Watch the documentary, you'll see what I'm talking about. I can't endorse the documentary fully because of some of the, you know, big names involved, let's say. And also, I mean, it starts and ends off with some kind of terrible hip-hop music. But for the most part, the arguments that are made in the documentary are solid, and I think it's an important aspect that has often been left out of the vegan versus carny debate, is just how beneficial this can be for any athlete, any person who just cares about their physical health, switching over to eating a lot of plant-based food. And it's so satisfying as well. Guys, the argument that is usually made against plant-based is that, and I've seen this from PragerU, and I've seen it from all the carny shills. PragerU recently did a short video about how the American guidelines screwed up the American health. So what they'll point to was, you know, at some point, maybe in the 70s, the government came out with guidelines that said that a low-fat diet is the way to go. And so they said, after that, the Americans' health just kept getting worse and worse and worse after people adopted the low-fat diet. Guys, nobody was actually following the government guidelines. Nobody. And actually, I've discussed this in the past. Meat and dairy consumption have gone up. It's switched a bit because of the supposed low-fat guidelines. Some people switched over to eating more chicken. But guys, chicken has a lot of fat, and chicken is not actually good for you. It's not a healthy meat. There is no such thing as, honestly, healthy meat. And it all has trans fat, and there is no healthy level of trans fat for you to eat. And so people might switch their fats and their meat and dairy just slightly and think that, oh, now I'm within, you know, the healthy ideal here. You know, instead of eating this kind of cheese, then they eat some cottage cheese or Greek yogurt or whatever the case may be. So they'd switch it around within the same paradigm and think that they were then, you know, following a low-fat diet. While whatever, 30% of their calories are still coming from fat. The American people are incredibly obese, and it's not because of them eating a low-fat plant-based diet. No, not at all. In fact, people who eat a low-fat plant-based diet are much, much healthier, have less fat on them than their carny counterparts. It's just really insane that this is the health crisis in America is being blamed on a low-fat diet that nobody was adopting. I'm telling you guys that when we see this argument being made, you have to realize that, yeah, there were some products that were being marketed as low-fat. Oh, low-fat crackers, this and that. But most people were still eating high-fat foods. Yeah, maybe it was a few percentage points less. And they're like, well, there's no difference between a high-fat diet and a low-fat diet. Well, that's because you never actually studied a real low-fat diet. You just had them switch over to some chicken breasts and eggs or something. It's ridiculous. Anyway, I'm going to go to a clip here from Dr. John McDougall talking about how carbs don't make you fat. Now, this is one of those things that I've received so much confusion from people about. When I tell them, they ask, you know, why are you in such good shape? I'm like, I wasn't always. I used to be almost 240 pounds at one point. And I say, and they say, well, what do you eat? I said, well, I'm on a vegan diet. They said, well, aren't you eating a lot of carbs? Yeah, of course I eat a lot of carbs. I eat tons of carbs. Why do you think I'm able to sustain my energy levels for so long? Why do I have such good endurance, conditioning? You know, it's because of the carbs. That's what fuels me. Well, carbs make you fat. I'm scared of carbs. People are literally scared of carbohydrates. Our world is insane. They think that they need to eat lots and lots of protein and fat and stay away from carbohydrates. Who does this benefit? It benefits the massively powerful animal agriculture industry. And it benefits the pharmaceutical medicinal industry, the whole doctor complex. Because if you're eating lots of fat and protein, you're going to be needing to go to the doctor and getting lots of pills all the time, get some of those statins. Whereas if you just ate plants, you could avoid the doctor entirely, pretty much. And unless you get in an accident or something, you probably won't be going to the hospital either. All right, so we're going to listen to this short presentation from one of Dr. McDougall's talks about how starch/sugar does not make you fat. Fat makes you fat. And why isn't it playing? Okay. One second. Here we go.
Starches are low in calories. They're very calorie dilute. In other words, when you eat them, you take in a lot of food. It fills the stomach. But just the right amount of calories. The second principle is the fat you eat is the fat you wear. This is something that I encourage people to keep as a mantra, is whenever they're worried about losing weight, they want to feel better and, you know, have the pounds come off. One of my most favorite mantras to give people is, the fat I eat is the fat I wear. See, the body does the most efficient thing possible with everything you give it. You give it sugar in the form of carbohydrates, and it uses that sugar to run the machinery through a process called glycolysis. It runs the machinery. That's the most efficient thing for the sugar to do. In the food is another source of calories, which is protein. What the body does with the protein is takes a little bit, it repairs things, builds new things, and then it dumps the excess protein out of the body into the urine. The body does not store protein. If it stored protein, it would store it in the muscles, and we'd all look like Arnold Schwarzenegger used to look like. Does not get stored. The third ingredient that provides calories in food is fat. The body does the most efficient thing possible with fat. It just moves it. It moves it from the fork and spoon to your abdominal fat stores. From my lips to my hips, the fat I eat is the fat I wear. Why would it do anything else? It's the storage dollar for when no food is available. That's what the purpose of fat is, to get you through the tough winter. It stores it so efficiently that it doesn't even change the chemical structure of the fat. I can go up to you with a needle, suck some fat out of your abdomen, thigh, or buttocks, take it to the laboratory, have it analyzed, and I can tell what kind of fat you like to eat. If your body fat is full of trans fats, then you like Crisco and margarine, other trans fat foods. It just gets stored right in there as trans fat. If you happen to like cold water marine fish and I biopsy you, I'll find omega-3 fats. You like dairy, I'll find C15, C17 fats, characteristic. So the fat you eat is the fat you wear. Just effortlessly moves it in, stores it without any limit at all. You see people who will store 1,000 pounds of fat. And when they have to take them to the hospital, they do it with a forklift and a truck. So the fat you eat is the fat you wear. Now, when you eat extra sugar, let me tell you what happens to extra sugar. Because, you know, a lot of you will want to eat. You'll want to eat a lot of food, which I encourage you to do. It's natural to eat. When you're hungry, you're supposed to eat. And you satisfy those sweet-tasting taste buds, and your hunger gets satisfied. Well, what if you eat more starch or sugars than you need? What happens to that extra sugar? People are taught that what happens to sugar when you eat it, like rice or table sugar, they're taught what happens to the sugar is the sugar is turned to fat, which then makes you fat. And if that were true, if, say, eating too much rice turned to fat and that made you fat, then we'd see in the past several billion obese Asians living on rice. And that's not what we see. What happens to extra sugar when you eat more sugar than, or more calories and sugar than you need, sugar is a ring structure, a very stable chemical ring structure. That ring structure is burnt as heat calories or calories for fidgeting. That ring structure would have to be broken down into a chain structure, which is a fatty acid structure, and that costs lots of calories, and the body doesn't do that. So the human body is very, very, very inefficient at making fat from sugar. You're taught the opposite, but that's not what the scientific truth is. We've known this for 40 years. I've written about it for 40 years. Is the body does not efficiently convert sugar into fat. It's too wasteful. So it just burns it off.
All right. So that was Dr. McDougall. You can listen to hours and hours of his presentations online. Now what I'd like to do is turn to Carnism Debunked here. Just found this recently. I thought it was a decent overview. Number one, introduction. Despite all the myths you may have heard from friends, family, and the general public, and all the scare stories put out in the media by PR companies hired to write fear-mongering articles by Big Ag, going vegan is not a health concern, and it is appropriate for people of all stages of life. All nutrients come from the sun and soil, and this is how they enter into the food supply in the first place, through animals eating plants and so on. The most comprehensive nutritional study in human history, the China Study, was conducted over a 20-year period by researchers from Oxford and Cornell universities in association with Chinese government scientists and concluded that a whole foods, plant-based diet free of animal products is the optimum diet for human health. As well as this, it showed that all of our main diseases, heart disease, cancer, diabetes, high blood pressure, stroke, etc., are caused or aggravated by the consumption of animal products, and that adopting a whole foods plant-based diet massively lowers your risk of those diseases. On top of this, studies such as the German vegan study showed that, on average, non-vegans have more nutritional deficiencies than vegans. So yes, you're actually more likely to be deficient in a wide range of nutrients as a non-vegan than you are as a vegan. Oh, by the way, testosterone levels? Higher in vegans. What about protein? The idea that vegans need to worry about their protein intake in any way whatsoever is a myth that just will not die. The largest study of its kind in history showed that the average vegan gets 70% more protein than they actually need every single day. And despite the myths that have been put out there, and in particular seems to be prevalent in the field of bodybuilding, no, you don't need to combine proteins from different food groups to get complete proteins. As it turns out, the only food in the entire food supply that doesn't have a complete amino acid profile is a meat product, gelatin. So unless that's your only food source, you don't need to worry about combining proteins. Amino acids such as carnitine and creatine found in meat are actually not dietary amino acids. That is, there is no need whatsoever for humans to consume them, as our own body produces the perfect amount needed of those amino acids, which is how those acids got into the herbivorous cow or the lamb you're eating in the first place, i.e. their own body producing it. It actually turns out that human breast milk, the perfect food for human beings, fine-tuned for us for over millions of years, has the lowest protein content of any animal milk in the world, less than 1% protein by weight. Given that no one reading this knows anyone who has ever died from protein deficiency, but knows several people who have died from cancer, protein is not a nutrient of concern for anyone, vegan or not. The strongest land animals on the planet, gorillas, rhinos, elephants, hippos, buffaloes, etc., all tend to be herbivores, thus fuel their superior muscle strength to any meat-eating human with a diet of plants, all of which have a full amino acid profile. What about calcium? Calcium is a metal and comes from the earth. The only reason there's any calcium in cow milk, which I assume you're associating it with, in the first place is because that cow, who is a vegan, by the way, eats grass, soy, or whatever else is fed to them. The calcium content in milk is designed by nature to actually, believe it or not, raise a baby cow. Humans have no need to drink cow milk for calcium than they do rat milk, dog milk, or chimp milk. Good vegan sources of calcium include dried herbs, sesame seeds, figs, tofu, almonds, flax seeds, Brazil nuts, and kale. If you're still unsure about calcium intake from plants in a vegan diet, most vegan milks are fortified with calcium, so just consume those as you would do any cow milk. Also, guys, apparently drinking cow milk will actually leach calcium from your body, because it does not have the proper amount of magnesium in there, as well as some other issues with it. What about iron? And guys, I'm reading through these because these are the questions that I've had for so long. I mean, these are just so standard. Well, what about the protein? What about your calcium? What about iron? You're going to be anemic. Okay, again, like calcium, iron is a metal and has nothing whatsoever to do with animals or the stuff that comes out of them. There is no link at all between veganism and anemia, which is iron deficiency. And vegans and vegetarians tend to get their RDA for iron without even thinking about it. Remember this rhyme for iron: nuts, beans, and dark leafy greens. Vegans generally have a far better intake of vitamin C than meat eaters, who are on average deficient in vitamin C, which aids iron absorption. The type of iron found in meat is heme iron, which is a type of iron your body cannot regulate properly and forces its way into the bloodstream. This in turn encourages production of free radicals, which can damage DNA and increase cancer risk. So it is safer as humans that we consume plant-based sources of iron, non-heme iron. What about B12? While we can only consume naturally occurring B12 via A, eating animal products, B, drinking dirty water, or C, eating our own excrement, none of which I advise, by the way, B12 is readily available for vegans in many fortified foods, soy milk, Marmite, nutritional yeast spreads, or can be consumed in the form of a supplement. So is there any shame in consuming fortified foods or taking a supplement because the food you eat does not naturally provide it, as many non-vegans seem to think is a case to argue against veganism? Not at all. It turns out that if, like me, you live in a developed or developing country, you're pretty much a walking supplement advert, and you probably don't even realize it. The bread you eat is fortified with vitamins. By law in certain countries, like the UK, juices are fortified. Cow milk has vitamins added to it during the manufacturing process. Table salt has iodine added to it. Livestock animals are fed or injected with supplements. Breakfast cereals are fortified, and unless they work outdoors, all meat. Dairy egg eaters, especially if they have darker skin, need to be taking a vitamin D supplement on a daily basis. All those listed foods are fortified because the vast majority of people, that's non-vegans, fail to get anywhere near adequate nutrition without them. So not only do non-vegans have no right to condemn vegans eating fortified foods or taking a supplement for B12 when 99% of non-vegans eat a heavily supplemented diet anyway, but it is actually advisable that you do eat fortified foods or take a supplement to cover your basic nutritional needs anyway. Yeah, B12 comes from the soil, and often the animals themselves are fortified with B12. So, and it seems like most meat eaters should be taking a B12 supplement as well. The whole problem with B12 seems to just be due to our whole food process that, you know, has happened in developed countries, because we're no longer getting a bit of dirt in our diet. Everything is obviously washed and cleaned. I'm not saying that's a bad thing, but it just removes B12 from our diet. What about omega-3? Just as the dairy industry has managed to get everybody to associate calcium with their product, so too have the fish and fish oil industries managed to get everybody to associate omega-3 with theirs. Contrary to popular belief, fish is not a health food. Riddled with mercury, dioxins, and PCBs, it is highly advisable that you consume plant-based sources of omega-3 to maintain a healthy heart, brain, and body. Good vegan sources of omega-3 include flax seeds, hemp seeds, edamame, wild rice, canola oil, no, walnuts, black beans, and kidney beans. What about vitamin D? Despite what critics of veganism will tell you, animal foods are not a good source of vitamin D. In fact, food with naturally occurring vitamin D, in general, is not. When it comes to naturally ingesting it, vitamin D is only reliably sourced through skin exposure to sunlight, at least 20 minutes per day if you are fair-skinned, longer if you have darker skin, depending on how dark it is. As such, it is advisable that, unless you spend a decent amount of your day outdoors, you eat fortified foods or take a supplement. A UK government commission report recently advised that all citizens take a vitamin D supplement, particularly in autumn and winter. Yeah, or else you get SAD, SAD, seasonal affective disorder. What about iodine? The richest sources of iodine on the planet are sea vegetables, seaweed, kelp, dulse, etc. But be careful not to overdo them, as your iodine levels might be too high if you do. I take a large amount of iodine, and it just gives me more energy. But yeah, you'd want to work up to that. What about non-processed meat? Isn't that healthy? The short and simple answer is no. While many people are aware that the World Health Organization recently declared processed meat, like bacon and sausage, a group 1 carcinogen that definitely caused cancer, and if you didn't know, now you do, most people are still of the belief that non-processed meats are healthy to consume. The truth is that all meat is carcinogenic, and even cooking chicken breast, for example, releases carcinogens in the meat and ups your cancer risk. In fact, meat is so carcinogenic that even being in the same room as it being fried or grilled can up your cancer risk, just from exposure to the fumes. Yeah, but doesn't everything give you cancer these days? Well, admittedly, a lot of things do, and the media sensationalism surrounding the idea of everyday items such as candles, lights, and just about anything giving you cancer has caused people to be skeptical of its claims. But the science is there for you to see that animal products most definitely do cause cancer, while fruits and vegetables actually lower your risk of it. Are vegan diets appropriate for children and pregnant women? Absolutely. The American Dietetic Association recently released a statement stating that fully vegan diets are appropriate for people of all stages of life, including for children and pregnant women. There are a lot of scare stories out there due to babies dying of malnutrition being fed a vegan diet by their parents, but rather conveniently, no newspapers seem to be interested in reporting on the many babies who die every week from malnutrition after being fed a non-vegan diet by their parents. Yeah, just, guys, think about how many little obese babies there are now these days. It's so sick. And it's not babies on a vegan diet, I'll tell you that. And then there are the ridiculous stories, I don't even know if they're real, about babies being given only wheatgrass or something instead of milk. Oh, that was supposedly Tabitha's explanation for why she wanted to jail vegan parents. And now she's pushing hardcore on the animal fats over at TCTA. Oh, yeah. Are vegan diets appropriate for athletes? Of course. Not only do vegan diets provide more than enough protein, but they're also high in complex carbohydrates, carbs being the primary source of energy for the human body, and naturally occurring nitrates. That's right, while athletes are cheating by taking nitrate drugs, vegan athletes are consuming them legally and naturally in the form of rocket, aka arugula, beetroot, etc. So plant-based diets actually boost your performance in a similar way that banned drugs can. That's how good they are for athletes. No wonder, then, that so many athletes are now switching to plant-based diets, even if not ethical vegans themselves. Yeah, it's just a smart move. Alright, so that's enough of that. You can look into the science behind all of this, but I'm not going to go through all of that. I'm going to keep it a rather short broadcast here tonight. What I'll do now, though, is I'll play a presentation by Dr. T. Colin Campbell, the author of the China Study, where he presents his findings.
I'm here to talk about health. Your health, my health, the health of your families and friends, especially our children. I'm actually here to talk about health and fact of our country. But talking about health, thinking about how we can get health, we are in a system today that is not exactly to our liking. I think many of you would probably agree that we have a healthcare crisis. 18% of our gross domestic product is accounted for by the money we spend for taking care of our health. In this country, the United States has the highest per capita health care costs in the world. We're twice as high as the next highest country. But in spite of all this money that's being spent, the quality of our health care, we've got to really face it. The quality of our health care in this country, according to the statistics and health indicators, we place us near last or last among similarly economically developed countries. On top of it, we've got another problem, too. We've got more than 50 million people who don't have health insurance. And that's up 40% just in the last decade. This is a fantastic business model, I think you would agree. It really has been. A lot of people are making a lot of money. But as far as health, it's not a good health model. In terms of looking to the future, what's likely to come because of this problem we presently have, if the tripling of childhood obesity during the last decade, or the last 30 years, is any indication, we're not going in the right direction. Especially when we think about, too, the invasion of our children by type 2 diabetes. It used to be called adult onset diabetes. We might as well put the children thing in it, too. Or the 83% increase in a harsh drug like Ritalin in our children during the last 4 years. Something's not quite right. I'm talking about prescription drugs, by the way. At the present time, 9 out of 10 people 60 years of age and older are consuming at least one or more prescription drugs on a regular basis. I'm not one of them, by the way. And I'm more than 60. Neither is my wife taking drugs. Prescription drugs costs, on the other hand, have doubled in the last decade, and that's after we take into consideration adjustment for inflation. And on this particular point, as much as we are using prescription drugs these days, it's sort of the centerpiece of our healthcare system. It turns out it's the number 3 cause of death. Some would say number 4, depending on how you divide up the first 3. But in any case, you don't see this listed in the causes of death in most of the popular reports. Something's missing. Something is missing from our system, and that's really what I want to talk to you about. I'd like to suggest it's nutrition. We don't understand it. It's confusing. And on this question concerning nutrition, let me just do a little defining here, if I may. Nutrition, if we think of it biologically, is actually using food to maintain health and prevent disease. And the typical diet that we now, in my view, believe is the healthiest possible diet is the so-called 80-10-10 diet. Namely, it's the nutrient composition having to do with 80 parts carbohydrate, 10 parts protein, 10 parts fat on the basis of an energy basis. And that translates into a practical message, what I'm talking about now. It's a whole food, plant-based diet with little or no of the three devils. Oil and fat being one, sugar and salt. That's the diet that really does create optimum health. And on that question concerning nutrient composition, by the way, nutrient composition is the index. It's the characteristic of food that best defines its effect on us in terms of health. And in terms of this nutrient composition question, antioxidants, complex carbohydrates, and vitamins, those are the key elements that really give rise to health. They're all found in plants. That's what plants really are. Plants make these things. Animal foods don't make these things. We might see a little antioxidants in animals from animal-based foods from time to time, but that has to do with the animals haven't eaten that kind of thing before they were slaughtered. Fat and protein are essential elements, absolutely essential elements. But it turns out that plants have around 9-11% or so of their on average. Animal-based foods have quite a bit more. So there's the distinctive difference between animal and plant-based foods. There's another class of foods that's crept into our society, too, in more recent decades that has to do with processed foods. Processed foods, their nutrient composition is all over the map. It depends on how one combines pieces of the other groups of foods. Processed foods also are not good because they tend to be very high in salt, sugar, and fat, the three devils. So I come back to my main point, it's whole plant-based foods that really are doing the job for us. Now, when people think about whole plant-based foods, we've known for a good long time, our grandmothers told us, our mothers told us, that it prevents future disease. But it's not only about using this diet to prevent future disease, and here is the kicker. Here is the thing that really matters that the public tend not to know. It's also about using this same kind of diet to actually treat existing disease. And I think this is a really important concept because it goes right to the core of what our healthcare and medical care system is all about. Here's a list of diseases, for example, that one can find in the legitimate scientific literature, in the peer-reviewed literature. Here are diseases that have been documented to be affected by a whole food plant-based diet. That is to say, this kind of diet prevents, suspends, that means stops the further progression, or cures all of these diseases. We can now cure heart disease in fairly late stages. We could cure type 2 diabetes in a very short period of time. I have spent more than 50 years in this field as an experimental researcher, if you will, in the area of nutrition. And I want to share with you a little bit about where I came from and why I think the way I do now. It's controversial for some, but nonetheless, I really believe in the data that we've obtained. Initially, I was involved in investigating nutrients on a one-by-one basis, and still today, that's the way research tends to work, looking at one thing at a time, just one thing at a time. But over the years, I finally came to the view, and this is really where the punchline is here. This is where the power of nutrition really exists. Nutrition should be recognized as the holistic effect of countless nutrients involving countless diseases, working through countless mechanisms. Now, I want to share with you just some, as I look back and sort of ask myself, how did I sort of get to this place? Because I didn't start here in my career some 50 years ago. And I want to share with you just a few observations that were taken from my own research quite a number of years ago now, 30, 35 years ago, that kind of set the stage in a way for developing some principles that apply to what nutrition and health really is all about. This model I'm going to be telling you about in the next three or four slides here involves a laboratory animal model, laboratory rats in this particular case, that have been genetically programmed to get cancer. And so let's see what we see. I'm interested in this particular case here to see what effect nutrition might have on that model where the genes are there to create the disease. When we feed, in this particular case, an animal that has the ideal levels of protein, that being about 20% of total protein, when we feed a diet that is 20% dietary protein, these cancers are growing well in the first 6 weeks in those animals. In contrast, when you feed a diet of 5% dietary protein, they don't, even though they've been genetically programmed to get the disease. This next observation really struck me as being quite significant. Namely, when we watch these sort of cancers growing in the first stage and switch the diet back and forth between 20% protein and 5% protein, you can see it there. We could get to a point where we could turn on and turn off cancer development, which is a very exciting concept. Because it basically says, in this case it's protein, but basically in a more general sense, it shows that nutrition controls cancer development. Very exciting concept. Instead of thinking about genes causing cancer or carcinogen is causing cancer or virus is causing cancer. Well, I'm talking about here in this particular case, nutrients, nutrition, basically controlling cancer development. Now, it turns out that the protein that we were using up until a certain point in time didn't pay a lot of attention to it because it was a protein that was available for us, was casein. Casein is the main protein of cow's milk. Why is that important? Well, soy and wheat protein, for example, does not increase cancer development like does casein. Here's a couple of plant proteins not doing it, one animal protein doing it. A major difference between the two. So it suggested at that particular point in time the hypothesis that maybe animal protein would promote cancer and plant protein would prevent cancer. And that came down as a fairly general statement that I was to carry through much of my research. It turned out that's the bifurcation that really led to this distinctive differences between these two different kinds of foods. Now, as I say, this is a little troubling for me personally at the time because actually I was raised on a dairy farm. There's me up front, maybe I think it's about 9.5 years ago or so. And another just sort of sidebar story here before I go on. I talked about casein, dairy, and so forth. And so we have a lot of evidence now that dairy is a troublesome food, a very troublesome food, not just because of what we found with respect to its ability to increase cancer. But, you know, my family, we don't use dairy anymore. We haven't in some time. And I suggest if we want to do it right, you know, get with the program. So let's get back then to the model that I was using just to tell you about some of the principles that, in fact, affected me and my thinking in a larger context as we went forward. Namely, in this particular case, we're looking at just not that 5%, 20% kind of thing, but we're looking at a range of protein concentrations in the food to see what happens. And you can see here that in the lower levels of protein, dietary protein, from 4 to 10% in this particular case, it's not the exact amounts I'm really concerned about here. It's the inflection that I want to talk about. But with up to about 10% dietary protein, what you can see is that protein is doing its good thing. It's not creating cancer. It's not promoting cancer. Protein is an essential nutrient. We need it. Everything's working fine. So what I'm talking about here is when we consume it in excess to the amount we need. And in fact, most of us humans actually live in that red zone where we're consuming in excess of what we need. So that 10% is enough, really is enough. And that actually is provided by a diet made up of whole plant-based foods. If we're consuming a diet of whole plant-based foods, we're actually getting the ideal levels of protein. We don't need more. But unfortunately, 95% of us, according to the national statistics, are consuming in excess of what we need, and we do that by actually consuming animal-based foods. Now, I want to just take you to just another little idea here coming from these experiments that I found very interesting. I'm just a little schematic, so just treat it as a schematic. I've just sort of given you two clusters of cells. One cluster of the red cells. Those are the ones, let's propose, they're the genetically programmed cells to give rise to cancer. The seed has been planted. The mutagenic event has occurred. Okay, those are the cells that are programmed to get cancer. The blue cells are normal cells. So on the left, we've got a high dose, let's say a high dose of genetically prone cancer cells. On the right, we've got a far less dose, just a little bit. Now, if all else is considered equal, if nothing else has changed beyond that point, obviously the one with the highest dose of the genetically programmed cancers are going to get more cancer. Fair enough. The ones on the right get less cancer. So in that particular case, it's legitimate to say that genes cause cancer. All diseases really start with genes at some fundamental level. So in this case, we can say genes cause cancer. Sort of makes sense. However, look what happens when we get to that stage. Now, our genes are constant over a lifetime, more or less. But we go beyond the genes. If we look in this particular model here, it turns out that if you take the cells in the left, where there's a very high degree of genetic concentration of the cells, feed them the low protein diets, we get less cancer, not more. In other words, you completely just switch it. So what really matters here is not the genes. What's mattering in this particular case is the expression of those genes. That, in turn, is controlled by nutrition. And that is really one of the most fundamental properties of nutrition across the board, not just in this particular model, but in this particular model, it was actually a key. It was a key. It was a lead-in, in fact, to a larger consideration. So nutrition controls cancer genes. It controls genes across the board. It's really quite interesting for all kinds of diseases. And so we can say nutrition trumps genes. That's my view, and we have lots of evidence now to really make that point. It's something we can do about rather than something we can't do anything about. And it turns out there's a list of these same diseases, again, that all basically start with genes controlled by nutrition. So I have a question in the current conversation we're having now. If nutrition controls genes, then why are we spending so much money for genetic research? In my estimation, it's a rough approximation, we're spending at least 100 times the amount of funding for genetic research than we do for nutrition research. When in fact it's nutrition that actually gives us the health. It's not the genes. Genetic research, of course, makes money. Or at least there's the perception of those who are making this money available that in fact it's doing that. Nutrition research only makes health. So it comes down to this. How do we understand nutrition? As I said in the beginning, it's about looking at one nutrient at a time. And we see that every day. The recommended dietary allowance is this nutrient, you need this much, food labeling. It's actually led to a vitamin supplement industry, as a matter of fact. A $30 plus billion industry. We now know that nutrient supplements really don't do the job. That's not what we need. I like to say, let's call that an old paradigm. The practice of medicine is the same sort of argument. At the present time, our health system, our medical practice system, is reductionist in nature. We think about single causes, single biomarkers. Go to the doctor, he tells you how much cholesterol you have, how much blood sugar, as if these are really things that count in all by themselves. Or single diseases, that's how we give them this international classification of disease code. Doctors get paid according to what they diagnose. By our thinking of health in terms of one thing at a time, remember in our little context like that, what it means is, okay, well now we're going to find one thing to cure a thing. We make drugs with all their side effects. That becomes the primary means of health maintenance. So I'm going to suggest we're at the threshold now. We can be at the threshold now of actually transforming the entire healthcare system and think of a different way. Think about what we can do, and that's really about nutrition. There's countless, as I said. We have to think about nutrition. This is a real challenge to the way we do research and the way we think about things. Nutrition is not a one-on-one kind of thing. It's a collective thing. We call it holism, a holistic kind of idea. It's really, quite frankly, is anathema as far as the scientific community is concerned. That's at least my experience. But that's what nutrition is, many diseases, working as a symphony. And interestingly, this is simple. It's very complex biology, but it's a simple solution. Just decide what we should put in our mouths. A whole food, plant-based diet, vegetables, fruits, grains, and legumes. Don't add back to oil, fat, and sugar. It's a lot cheaper. It really works. And as far as coming back to my initial thesis is concerned, we now have information, empirical data, to actually show that if you take a group of people, I've been involved in a couple of these tests now. If you take a group of people, give them the right food, the things that happen to us, whether we have a disease or not, are remarkable. You can see these things within a week or two. Cholesterol go down, body weight drops off. And I'm going to say that should be the future of medicine. Or let's say, I don't like the word medicine. Let's say it's the future of food and the future of our health. Thank you.
All right. That was T. Colin Campbell. Now to finish this off, I'm just going to read some quotations here. And the first one is very relevant given the presentation we just heard there. And this one's from Hippocrates. Let food be thy medicine and medicine be thy food. And really, do you guys think a cheeseburger should be your medicine? Here's an Ayurvedic proverb, which is pretty similar. When diet is wrong, medicine is of no use. When diet is correct, medicine is of no need. And yet Miss Ayurvedic over there, Tabitha, used to be talking about white wellness and plant-based things. She's now saying that, well, you know, you need to be eating lots of fish and cheeses and organ meats and all sorts of sick stuff. And here's another one from the Bhagavad Gita. When you feel the suffering of every living thing in your own heart, that is consciousness. Some people just seem so callous that they really don't care whatsoever that many, many animals have to be slaughtered for them to sustain their hedonistic lifestyle that is killing them. Here's one from Thomas Edison. Nonviolence leads to the highest ethics, which is the goal of all evolution. Until we stop harming all other living beings, we are still savages. One from Leonardo da Vinci. The time will come when men such as I will look upon the murder of animals as they now look upon the murder of men. Here's one from Plato. The gods created certain kinds of beings to replenish our bodies. They are the trees and the plants and the seeds. Pythagoras. For as long as man continues to be the ruthless destroyer of lower living beings, he will never know health or peace. For as long as men massacre animals, they will kill each other. Indeed, he who sows the seeds of murder and pain cannot reap joy and love. Here's Plutarch. A human body in no way resembles those that were born for ravenousness. It hath no hawk's bill, no sharp talon, no roughness of teeth, no such strength of stomach or heat of digestion as can be sufficient to convert or alter such heavy and fleshly fare. There is nobody that is willing to eat even a lifeless and dead thing, even as it is. So they boil it and roast it and alter it by fire and medicines, as it were, changing and quenching the slaughtered gore with thousands of sweet sauces, that the palate, being thereby deceived, may admit of such uncouth fare. Okay, Plutarch obviously did not know spherage and the great ways of the carnivore crowd. Sick. Voltaire. How pitiful and what poverty of mind to have said that the animals are machines deprived of understanding and feeling. It's a very Christian concept. Judge, in the same way as you would judge your own, the behavior of a dog who has lost his master, who has searched for him in the road barking miserably, who has come back to the house restless and anxious, who has run upstairs and down from room to room, and who has found the beloved master at his last in his study, and then shown his joy by barks, bounds, and caresses. There are some barbarians who will take this dog, that so greatly excels man in capacity for friendship, who will nail him to a table and dissect him alive in order to show you his veins and nerves. And what you then discover in him are all the same organs of sensation that you have in yourself. Answer me, mechanist. Has nature arranged all the springs of feeling in this animal to the end that he might not feel? Has he nerves that he may be incapable of suffering? Henry David Thoreau. One farmer says to me, "You cannot live on vegetable food solely, for it furnishes nothing to make the bones with." And so he religiously devotes a part of his day to supplying himself with the raw material of bones, walking all the while he talks behind his oxen, which, with vegetable-made bones, jerk him and his lumbering plow along in spite of every obstacle. Another one from Henry. I have no doubt that it is a part of the destiny of the human race, in its gradual improvement, to leave off eating animals, as surely as the savage tribes have left off eating each other. No, they're trying to bring us back to that, too. And they're using raw meat as a gateway into eating humans. Fyodor Dostoevsky. Love animals. God has given them the rudiments of thought and joy untroubled. Do not trouble their joy. Don't harass them. Don't deprive them of their happiness. Don't work against God's intent. Man, do not pride yourself on superiority to animals. They are without sin, and you, with your greatness, defile the earth by your appearance on it, and leave the traces of your foulness after you. Alas, it is true of almost every one of us. Leo Tolstoy. A man can live and be healthy without killing animals for food. Therefore, if he eats meat, he participates in taking animal life merely for the sake of his appetite. And to act so is immoral. Mark Twain. Of all the creatures, man is the most detestable. of the entire brood. He's the one that possesses malice. He's the only creature that inflicts pain for sport, knowing it to be pain. The fact that man knows right from wrong proves his intellectual superiority to the other creatures. But the fact that he can do wrong proves his moral inferiority to any creature that cannot. Twain also said, whenever you find yourself on the side of the majority, it's time to pause and reflect. And guys, I know that you think veganism is just everywhere. The UN Agenda 21 coming for us. The vast majority of advertisements out there, the vast majority of restaurants, the vast majority of media, and the vast majority of people are all pushing the same line that we need to eat animal products to be healthy. Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, at the moment, our human world is based on the suffering and destruction of millions of non-humans. It's billions now. To perceive this and to do something to change it in personal and public ways is to undergo a change of perception akin to a religious conversion. Nothing can ever be seen in quite the same way again, because once you have admitted the terror and pain of other species, you will, unless you resist conversion, be always aware of the endless permutations of suffering that support our society. And I'll finish off with some Hitler quotes. According to the Table Talks of November 11, 1941, Hitler said, "One may regret living at a period when it's impossible to form an idea of the shape of the world of the future that it will assume. But there's one thing I can predict to eaters of meat. The world of the future will be vegetarian." On January 12, 1942, he is said to have said, "The only thing of which I shall be incapable is to share the sheik's mutton with them. I'm a vegetarian, and they must spare me from their meat." And there's a diary entry of Joseph Goebbels from April 26, 1942, where he wrote, "An extended chapter of our talk was devoted by the Führer to the vegetarian question. He believes more than ever that meat eating is harmful to humanity. Of course, he knows that during the war we cannot completely upset our food system. After the war, however, he intends to tackle this problem also. Maybe he is right. Certainly, the arguments that he adduces in favor of his standpoint are very compelling." So, guys, had Hitler won the war, maybe the future he foresaw would have come about sooner. Maybe we would have far more vegans now if the Jews and their allies had not won World War II. Again, I quote from Hitler, "The world of the future will be vegetarian." All right, thanks so much for listening. Thank you to the supporters. I hope you take these words to heart. I'm not doing it to just shame you or anything like that. I am doing it because I love you, and I love our people, and I love the animals, and I love the world in which we live, and I hate to see the suffering that is caused needlessly by these nourishing traditions that are being promoted by fat, disgusting people like Sally Fallon. Anyway, we'll have much more for you to come, so please do stay tuned. Talk to you all again soon.